Session number 1812, rule 2.
General Foote, rule 2.
And they've got to be able to get out of the beach, and there were only a limited number of places where they could do this. And so it was quite easy to decide if they were going to come where the most likely places would be. And I must say that he did that with all the arms branches, the gunners and the sappers and various other arms branches. I suppose his idea was that if he'd put the thing through normal channels, it would have gone across to the CIGS, who would have sent for the director responsible, who would have sent for his G1, who would have sent for the G2 or G3 to give the necessary detailed information. And that would probably have taken a week. And in actual practice, of course, he got it straight away within 24 hours. And so it was a time-saving exercise, I think, more than anything else.
We should say that these discussions took place at 10 Downing Street.
10 Downing Street, yes.
What impression did Lindemann make on you?
Oh, he was a very nice chap. he obviously knew exactly what he wanted, and he put various questions through one which were unanswered.
I think after this, in July 1940, you were posted to the 40th Tanks.
That's right, yes.
What was that for?
That was a new tank regiment that had been a territorial one, and I was posted as the second in command there. And we were stationed down in Kent at
Crowborough?
Crowborough, And we were training there until one day I was told that I was to go over to America to have a look at their maneuvers. And so I went off there with another tank chap, and we also had infantry and artillery and people. We were being attached to the American Army Divisions. They only had two in those days, first and the second. And they were taking part in maneuvers down near...
Louisiana,
yes, in Louisiana, near, which was very much a... We discovered later... The maneuvers were really to prepare the American army for the Philippines, and the maneuvers took part in the most unlikely tank country, which was all bogs and river crossings and things like that. And so we went down there. And the other thing which really paid a dividend was we were able to discover that the American tank users in those days had no say at all in the production of their equipment. It was all done by their ordnance, who said, "There's your tank, take it and like it." And we were able to tell the generals commanding their division that this was a bad way to do it, and it was much better for the user to have an early say on what was required. And they very soon tumbled to that, and then they formed an equivalent to what we had in our war office, was that a tank equivalent in their army headquarters. And so that the thing, of course, they learned pretty quickly, the Americans. They were very good that way. And I think that, of course, they weren't in the war then. They were still at peace.
Did the American tank units impress you or not?
Did they what?
Did they impress you or not?
Oh yes, I think they impressed one. They were always very mobile. They always be able to dash about quickly. Oh yes, I think they were obviously the material was there. It's only a question of getting the equipment, which they did in a very short space of time, of course.
So you actually went out into the swampland to watch the manoeuvres, did
you? Yes, went out and took part in manoeuvres. From our point of view, from the tank point of view, it wasn't much use because it was all in this bogland, which obviously wasn't tank country. However, we were able to talk to their tank chaps, and they asked us for all our experiences up to date. And we were able to impress them. The main thing was to get a gun which could penetrate the enemy's armor at a shorter distance than theirs could penetrate ours.
I think after these maneuvers, you went to Fort Knox, did you not?
Yes, yes.
What was that for?
Well, merely to see the equipment they got and to make contact with their people there.
No.
The American Armored School.
Did you then go home?
I went up to Canada and saw the Canadian Canadian Armored Units. And was able to go to the school and see how they were getting on with that training. I also went to the Canadian Staff College and gave a lecture to them on our experiences to date. And then a signal came through that I was wanted urgently back in London to take up a new appointment, and the rest of them, we were all prepared to go back by sea on a ship, and so I was to be flown back, and so I went to Montreal, got on an airplane and flew first of all to Gander, where we were due to refuel and have a meal before we flew the Atlantic. And everything went according to plan. I got to Gander, we landed, and then we got back into the aeroplane, ready to fly across to England. And we got up and we flew round, and after about 5 minutes, we realized we were still flying round the aerodrome. And we had the Air Marshal of Canada on board. And a note came back from the pilot to the Air Marshal explaining that he couldn't get his undercarriage up and that we couldn't fly the undercarriage with the undercarriage up, and so we'd have to go round until we could shake it down. This we did. We flew round the aerodrome, and without any luck, we couldn't shake it down. And at that time, the Gander, there was an American detachment which had been allowed to have landing rights there in exchange for the 50 destroyers that which we had given them. At that time, American Liberator planes were being paid to Britain via Montreal and Gander in Newfoundland. I joined a Liberator of Montreal, which was piloted by O.P. Jones, who was a leading BOAC pilot. Also on board was the Air Marshal of Canada. We passengers sat in the bomb bay where there was no heating. We were each given two Sitka suits and a fur helmet to put on, as we had to fly over the weather in the Atlantic with very low temperatures. The flight to Gander from Montreal was uneventful, and we touched down at Gander in the late afternoon, and had a meal there before taking off again that evening. Gander was just an aerodrome in the centre of Newfoundland, completely surrounded by forests, and the only other link with the outside world was a light railway which went to St. John's on the coast. At that time, Britain had just agreed to allow America to establish a small base on certain of our aerodromes in exchange for 50 destroyers. Gander was one of them. So there was an American detachment at Gander, and they had an American army band. We took off that evening in the dark for Prestwick in Scotland, where we were scheduled to arrive next morning. However, on looking out, we noticed that we appeared to be flying round the aerodrome at Gander. Shortly afterwards, the pilot sent a note back to the Air Marshal to say he could not get his undercarriage up, and as we could not fly the Atlantic with the undercarriage down, there were two alternatives. One, to land straight away and run an almost certain risk of buckling the undercarriage due to the weight of the fuel on board, or two, to fly round Gander till we had used up most of our fuel in order to land safely. This, we estimated, would take about 2 hours. There was no method of jettisoning fuel on a Liberator. The Air Marshal of Canada, who by that time had had a good ration of whiskey, wrote back, "Who is the captain of this ruddy ship, you or I? If it's you, make your own ruddy decisions." Back came a note to say we continue to circle the airport until we'd used up sufficient fuel. We'd been flying round for about half an hour when another note came back to the Air Marshal to say the ground station at Gander had signalled to say they were expecting a snowstorm to arrive shortly with heavy icing conditions, and that if we did not land now, we might not be able to land at all. He, O.P. Jones, had decided to land forthwith. As there was nothing much else to do at Gander, the population, which had been kept informed of our plight, was assembled round the airstrip to watch the fun, including the American band, which was drawn up on the edge of the runway and was playing to the assembled multitude. O.P. Jones, who was a very skillful pilot, brought the plane down safely onto the runway, but with the excess weight of the fuel, the undercarriage folded up, and we came to a halt plumb opposite the band, which, as we got out of the aircraft, struck out "Home Sweet Home." Although we didn't know it at the time, we were to write off 6 aircraft before we were at last able to leave Gander 28 days later. The second one taxied to the end of the runway, where the pilot tried to rev up the engine and found he could not get sufficient power. On checking, they found a 3-inch icicle in the main fuel pipe. Number 3 was being pulled out of its hangar, caught its tail fin against the hangar door, which had not been opened far enough, and wrenched it off. Number 4 developed electrical faults, and the pilot said it was not fit to fly. Number 5, on taxiing out, caught its wing against another aeroplane wing, and both planes were written off. Number 6, the pilot did not like the engine and wanted it rechecked before taking off. It must be remembered, of course, that the maintenance staff at Gander had a number of untrained men that had to be hurriedly increased to deal with the extra amount of traffic as a main staging station between America and Europe. When we finally got airborne again after 28 days, we had to fly over the weather at a height of 40,000 feet. The temperature recorded 73 degrees of frost, so we were glad of our 2 Ritzik suits and fur helmets. We had coffee in the thermos flasks, which kept lukewarm, but our sandwiches were so brittle that you could snap them in 2. The flight was otherwise uneventful, though we were glad to see the coast of Ireland looming up in the early morning light, and the sunrise was really beautiful. We landed at Prestwick on the 28th of November, where I found a note to say the military secretary wanted to see me as soon as possible. We all had a Canadian dollar note signed by the pilot, which was the fashion at that time, to say to show that we had flown the Atlantic.
I think it was at this time that you went to take up a post in Palestine. Can you tell me what that was and what your duties were supposed to be there?
I saw the military secretary, and he told me that I was wanted urgently to take up the post of GSO-1, 10th Armoured Division, which was stationed in Palestine. So after a short leave, I was ordered to report to RAF headquarters in Poole, Dorset, and was to fly out to the Middle East in a Catalina flying boat, as we had to go out and land in neutral countries to refuel. We were to travel in Mufti. From Poole Harbour, we flew to Shannon in Yarra, and from there we had to make a wide sweep out into the Atlantic because of German planes stationed in France. We landed on the Tagus at Lisbon and spent a night at in Portugal and were put up at a hotel in Estoril. We were able to visit the casino there and met a number of Germans also in Mapte playing at the tables. Our next stop was Gibraltar, where we stayed a night, and we were able to visit the apes on the rock. Then we took off for Malta, where we were due to stop another night. The next morning, the sea was too rough for the Catalina to take off, so we were told to stay another night. However, there was a Wellington on its way to the Middle East, which had landed about midday and had also decided to spend that night in Malta. However, about 6 p.m., we were told that the air officer commanding the RAF in Malta was not going to allow the Wellington to stop overnight in view of the continual bombing raids from the German and Italian bombers based in Sicily. So we were ordered to fly out with the Wellington. We got airborne and crossed the Malta defences when I got a message from the pilot to say that in the confusion of our rapid departure, he had left his maps and recognition signals behind. Could I help? I said if he flew about 200 miles due east and then 100 miles due south, we would probably be over Egypt. Luckily, also on board as passengers were two Fleet Air Arm personnel. One was a pilot and the other a navigator, who were going out to crew a Fleet Air Arm plane at Alexandria. The navigator had a set of maps with him, but did not have the recognition signals, so he took us over the navigation. He took over the navigation. We actually crossed the Egyptian coast on the wrong side of Mersematru and got shot up by our own anti-aircraft guns. However, they were so thin on the ground they did not worry us. In due course, we were able to land at Cairo West, and I reported to Middle East headquarters in Cairo. After a couple of days staying at Shepherd's Hotel, I flew up to Palestine and took over my job at GSO 1, 10th Armored Division. The divisional headquarters was at Rehoboth, and our AMS was in Wiseman's house there. The commander was General Clark, the cavalryman, who admitted he knew very little about tanks. The division had recently been converted from a horse cavalry division, and most of the units were yeomanry regiments. Luckily, most of the reservists who had been called up in the units were ex-RTR men, so the mechanical side presented few problems. One of the jobs I was given was to reconnoitre the lava belt between Palestine and Iraq to see where armour could operate in case the Germans came down through the Caucasus and threatened the Middle East. The main oil pipeline from Iraq to Haifa crossed this area, and we were able to explore the various pumping stations en route to see how we could best defend them. the end of April, I was ordered to take over command of 7th Armoured Regiment. The regiment was at that time in a camp in the desert between Cairo and Amrea, and we were equipped with Mark II Matilda tanks. May 1942 saw both sides building up their forces. The British were deployed in a number of fortified boxes covered by minefields along a line stretching from the sea in the north to Bir Hakeim in the south. This was known as the Gazala Line. We had two armoured divisions stationed ready to cover the southern flank. The boxes were manned by infantry, supported by artillery. In the north, the line was held by the 1st South African Division and 50 Div, supported by parts of 1st and 33rd Army Tank Brigade. In the south were 150 Brigade, the Free French Brigade in Bir Hakeim, and the 3rd Motor Brigade, 150 Brigade, had the 44th RTR from the 1st Army Tank Brigade in support. On the German side, the line was held by the Italian division, while Rommel kept his two panzer divisions, 15 and 21, and 90th Light Armored Division, in reserve. On the 21st of May, my regiment was put on 12 hours' notice to move up to the desert. At 3 p.m. on the 22nd of May, we moved off, our tanks going up to by train to Merzimetru from Amrea, and the rest by road. From Merzimetru, the tanks were moved forward on transporters. We reached our position behind the 1st South African Division on the 27th of May and joined up with the 33rd Army Tank Brigade, commanded by Brigadier Willison. The brigade was in support of the 1st South African Division. Rommel's plan was to open with a frontal attack on the 1st South African Division and 50 Division